Blog Talk Radio.
You are about to enter into the world of the paranormal, a world of ghosts, UFOs, demons, Bigfoot, and generally anything unexplained. We live in a diverse world where we don't fully understand everything that happens around us. These are the topics that we are discussing on Paranormal Horizons. Stay tuned with your hosts, Jason Ophir and Sherry Pang, as we look a little deeper into the world of the paranormal. Paranormal Horizons begins now. Good evening, everybody. This is Jason Ophir here with the beautiful and talented Sherry Pang for another episode of Paranormal Horizon. Sherry, how are you doing?
Hey, pretty good, Jason. A little bit tired today. I've been on tour, and, man, I'm just totally wiped out. So I'm just kind of relaxing and, you know, just taking it really easy. So how about you? How you been, Jason?
Been good. You know, I've started a new job. I actually like it so far, and been very interesting working in a hospital. You got to give props out to people that work in hospitals. It's wonky. I have to go to the ER and ICU and all that kind of stuff. And man, the stuff you see is just really, really crazy. But it's been going all right. Job's going good. There's a couple things I wanted to announce really quickly. Is one, I've been really bad about not having a chat available for the show. So I'm trying my best to remember to do that. So I do have a chat window open. So if anybody's listening to Paranormal, well, I guess everybody would be listening on the Blog Talk site, but I don't know if chat works if you're on a mobile device. But if you are on your computer, there should be a chat window open. And I'll try and keep an eye on that if anybody has any questions that we can present to our guest. And the other thing is that I have the Oculus Rift VR system, which is this headset that kind of immerses you in a digital world for video games and virtual reality experiences. And I figured out, I spent some time this weekend to figure out how to live cast that onto Facebook or YouTube or whatever. So I thought it would be fun on our Facebook page, Paranormal Horizons on Facebook, to live cast a video of a paranormal game. It's a scary one called Affected the Manor. So I did that, and it's available on the Facebook page. So check it out. I'm pretty used to the scary games and stuff like that, so I don't freak out. Nothing really startles me. But if anybody's interested to see what virtual reality is like, or virtual reality in terms of paranormal games, there's that there. So check that out on our Facebook page. And that's what I got to announce.
Yay. That sounds pretty cool. I'll check it out after we're done with the show. That'd be cool.
Yeah. I highly recommend anybody that's into, not even so much, you don't even have to be into gaming, just technology or being immersed in a world, the Oculus Rift or HTC Vive, any of those kind of systems, it's really mind-blowing where the technology has gone and how immersive it is. It's really incredible.
That's awesome. Wow. I'm not into games myself, but, you know, I can actually say that my husband loves playing those kind of games like you're talking about, Jason, and then some. And so it's just a new passion, and it's something that, you know, kind of, you know, it's good to, it's kind of neat to be able to play with all different kinds of people all over the world. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and a lot of the games on there are multiplayer. So, you know, if you want to live out your dreams of meeting aliens or being in a really, really messed up haunted house, well, the messed up haunted house, check out the Facebook video because it's pretty, it feels like you're there. I mean, the video won't do it justice, but like when you've got the headset on with the headphones, it feels like you're there totally. But
wow.
Anyway, so yeah, so what do we got lined up tonight?
Well, we're going to have a returning guest. He's just absolutely phenomenal. I'm going to say this, and it's a very, I feel like he's kind of a mentor towards me in our conversations, our personal conversations. The guy is just phenomenal. Just a wealth of information, willing to share, and I can't say anything bad about him. He's just amazing, and we're going to talk tonight. We're going to talk probably a few things. I don't know, depending on how he feels or what the conversation, but we're going to talk about certifications. And we're also maybe talking about ashes. I was just interesting watching his tweets and how his responses about cremation and ashes. So Brian Ouellette is a regular guest on Ghost Adventures, and most of you know it's one of the top-rated ghost shows that are on cable. And, you know, Zach Bagan is the real deal. I do feel that he is a sensitive and, you know, knows his stuff. And, you know, when Zach Bagan has a real problem with demonic oppression or possession, the first person they call is Brian Ouellette. So we're going to have him back on the show, and it's always a pleasure to have him. We're going to introduce him now.
Cool. We'll bring him on right now. Hey,
hello,
Brian.
How are you guys doing? Hey.
Doing good. How are
doing
you?
Good. Great. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing well, doing well. Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Hey, we were going to talk about, and I'm excited about this, is we're going to talk about where we were thinking about, and first of all, you know, these are just the thoughts, and it's not, you know, it's not something that when we talk about these, this is not a, like you have to think this way. We're just broadening a perspective or thought or anything. So we were talking about, a month or two ago about, what was it, talking about Reiki? Certifications and things like that?
Yes, yeah, Reiki. Yes, we were. And it comes up on Twitter. I mean, I know you mentioned that you follow all the tweets and everything else that, you know, people ask me all sorts of different questions on Twitter. And I try to be a pretty active member of the Twitter community because it is an opportunity for me to teach more about the work that I do and some of the expertise that I can lend to the field of, you know, not just paranormal investigation, but metaphysics and philosophy and religion itself, because I try to cover the gamut. And so Twitter's a great opportunity because, you know, you don't have a lot of characters in which to communicate. So people ask quick questions and I can, you know, usually find a few seconds to give a quick answer. And, you know, a lot of people have questions about all sorts of things, and you know, not just related to the paranormal or my work as an exorcist, but, you know, even things that are pertaining to religion. And so, yes, the subject of Reiki came up, and whether or not a person, you know, can or what's required, I should say, to be able to consider yourself a proficient master of Reiki. And unfortunately, because it is a metaphysical field in itself, there is no standardization that can be given. There's no actual government authorized certification for it. So people can just declare themselves to be proficient in this particular area of metaphysics and open up a practice and start teaching, you know, not just teaching it, but doing healings for people. And it's actually quite dangerous. It's actually quite dangerous to end up going to a person who might have read a few books or maybe even went and studied under some teacher who had a workshop at a New Age bookstore or something. I mean, I see it. We in Atlanta, we have our a few New Age areas where people can go for workshops, and they offer, you know, this so-called Reiki master will come in and teach a class, and I guess they get some type of certification through that person. I'm not really sure. But the fact of the matter is, what people don't understand about Reiki is that it's actually, you know, a Japanese Buddhist technique. And it takes years, if not decades, of study as a monk in a monastery, preferably in Japan, where that type of Buddhism is practiced, in order to truly develop mastery of what Reiki is. It came to this country because, you know, some people did actually finally, you know, at some point go out to Japan to learn it. But, you know, they came back here and they started teaching it, and then, you know, and then they gave crash courses in it. And yes, you can teach, you know, because Reiki is about energy systems. It's about channeling and directing energy systems. And I mean, anybody can do that. But the problem is, in order to do it in a way that does not cause or inflict spiritual harm, which eventually leads to, if it's, you know, if it happens, it leads to emotional and psychological harm, which can eventually lead to even physiological harm. You know, unless you know how to direct it correctly, unless you have, you know, developed the proficiency of skill that's necessary to call yourself a Reiki master, you really shouldn't be doing it. You know, I mean, it's we see a lot of people who develop spirit attachments because they either went to a so-called Reiki master or they ended up, you know, studying it themselves and playing around with it, and probably because the workshop told them that they could. So, you know, you and I had that conversation, and I was glad to hear that, you know, you're very familiar with the authentic Reiki, which is not typically accessible to the average person. I mean, it's a commitment. You have to be willing to give your life to the study and lifestyle of Buddhism and to lock yourself away in a monastery and not just study Reiki, but study everything that's involved in being a Buddhist monk, which Reiki is a very small part of. And only in certain types of Buddhism itself. And it's also
just
pretty,
like when, in a good way, that's, I can understand that, Brian, because when I was going to school in Chinese medicine, you're not just teaching, you're not being taught just the 200 or 250 meridian system in the body and what this and cause and this and that and everything else. You're also learning the spiritual practice, you know, of that, whether it's Taoism,
yeah,
or Confucianism and things like that, and knowing the way of how they think before you actually do the clinicals.
And that is critical. It's critical to being able to develop the type of proficiency that's necessary in order to effectuate Reiki correctly. Because, I mean, it's an alternative medicine system. It's fairly modern, actually, but there really is only one Reiki master, and that was the Buddhist monk who developed it. There really isn't, I mean, there is no other mastery. I mean, you go and you can learn the techniques that he taught, but honestly, anybody who claims to be a Reiki master who did not go to Japan and become a Japanese Buddhist monk is really just pretending. And I know I'm going to get a lot of people who are upset with me for saying that, but it's just a simple fact. I'm not going to go to a, you know, some type of a person who studied a few New Age books or even, let's make it even more real world. I'm not going to go to a guy who studied a few books on symptomology and then, you know, maybe take a few workshops with him and then go out there and call myself a doctor and open up practice and start treating people. I mean, that would be completely unethical. It would be illegal for one thing, but it's dangerous. It's illegal for a reason because it causes harm. Reiki is no different. I mean, would you want a surgeon operating on you who didn't actually go and study to be a surgeon the correct way. Of course not. Everyone would say no. Of course, you if you have to go for surgery, God forbid, you're going to want somebody who, you know, is skilled and proficient in the study of the type of medicine that has the treatment that you need. And Reiki is no different. It's just the problem is we're still living in a world where spiritual things, metaphysical things, are not largely taken seriously by the mainstream fields of academia. And because of that, there is no regulation to it. And people can just claim anything they want. They can do whatever they want. And there's no ramifications for it because it's all seen as superstition anyway. And that's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate, but that's just the way it is.
It's really sad, too, because, you know, in Tai Chi or Qigong or Kung Fu or you're going into yoga, a lot of these people are coming up with certifications and not saying, you know, you're right, I may probably going to get some slack on this, too, but, you know, you go in and they say, oh, we're going to have a black belt. There's so many degrees to get a black belt and this and that and everything else. And it's like, you know, just because you have a black belt doesn't mean you're proficient. You know, it's just,
those are just,
you know, titles or certifications. It's a piece of paper. It's a lifetime of learning and having teachers or mentors or people sharing what they are so that it helps with your growth process and being able to become proficient. It's by doing that you learn. It's not just saying, oh, yeah, you take a few classes, oh, yeah, and then you get one step ahead or you take certifications here, four-day workshop, you pay $2,000, there you go. You know, that kind of thing, I feel exactly the same way. But like I said, it's just my opinion. Doesn't mean it makes it right.
Right.
I've seen a lot of that, too.
Have you?
Seen a lot of that.
I imagine. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, with just like, you know, there's these online ministry things where you can be a minister and people, you know, send the information and pay a few bucks and then they're an ordained minister and they're out doing exorcisms and house clearings or marriages. And just, it's out of control.
Especially in the spiritual field, you know, when I do these shows, you'd be surprised that every other person is like that. It is so true, honestly. Or they'll hit the tarot cards like, okay, you have a problem? Here's the tarot cards. Let's They don't even let them touch it. They're just going to shuffle them and just say, oh, this is what happens, you know, kind of thing. It's really weird. Yeah, strange.
No, you know, and I like the fact that you mentioned that, Jason, about, you know, online ministries, you know, online ordinations, because, you know, that is basically a legal document that gives you the means and the right, I guess you could say, to affiliate with some real inadequate organization that just is basically like a diploma mill that just hands out ordinations to anybody who wants them. And I'm not going to name names, but I mean, there's quite a few out there to choose from. Just do a Google search and you'll see. And that's not an ordination. I mean, you know, that's not going, I get people sometimes that will apply to be a part of my team or even want to join the church. And you know, my application on my website will ask, you know, if they're ordained. And then I always, of course, ask by whom, you know, where did you receive your ordination? And, you know, inevitably, I get a lot of people who went and received some type of online thing. And now they think that they're clergy and that I can just incarnate them into my church and they can start operating as an exorcist because, you know, I guess they think it's cool to be an exorcist and they want to be involved in it. You know, it doesn't work like that. You know, if there is no laying on of hands by a valid, bishop who has the power of apostolic succession behind him because his bishop laid hands on him and his bishop laid hands on him going all the way back to the apostles themselves, then you're just pretending. You're not really a clergy in the sense of what it requires to be a Catholic exorcist. And they don't understand this. They really don't. And so they get very discouraged and sometimes even angry at me when I say, I can't incarnate you because our church doesn't recognize that as an ordination. If you, I mean, we'd be welcome to discern with you. and you can explore the possibilities of a vocation to the priesthood with us, but you're going to have to start at the beginning like a layperson, because we don't recognize those as actual valid ordinations. There was sometimes no human contact. It's just a piece of paper that got sent through sometimes email, and they download it. It's unbelievable what goes on.
Yeah,
so
That's true. I saw that too.
I questioned somebody on this one time, and basically their argument back to me was, well, you know, I was an altar boy and I lead service at my Christian church, and it's just a piece of paper. It's not important. It's what's in your heart, and if you have God in your heart, you have the power to do these things. And that's the response I got. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, it is true that, you know, a baptized, at least speaking from the Catholic Christian tradition, it is true that a baptized Christian is baptized into the priesthood of all believers, which is a priesthood, but it's not the same kind of priesthood that holy orders or the sacrament of holy orders imparts to a person who receives the laying on of hands by a bishop. That's a particular grace. That requires preparation and vocation. There has to be a calling by God to this service. So, you know, I really kind of get annoyed when people say, I want to be an exorcist, because, no, you really should be telling me you want to be a priest because you think God is calling you to priesthood, because there is no becoming an exorcist. You become a priest, and then from the clerical ranks of the priesthood are exorcists selected. But it doesn't work. You don't become a priest because you want to be an exorcist. You know, that's not the way it works. And so how I respond to people who say that is, yes, it's true that being baptized into the priesthood of all believers, that does empower us with the grace of Christ, which does also give us a certain amount of authority over evil. And so, yes, a lay person in theory can perform an exorcism, but it is not authorized by the church because it is too dangerous to do so without the skill, training, and preparation that's necessary and can only be granted by the sacrament of holy orders. So this is why it's not done. Now, the laity in the Catholic Church anyway are allowed to perform minor exorcisms. There's certain minor exorcisms that they can perform. The prayer to St. Michael is one example of a minor exorcism that any lay person can pray as a means to protect themselves against a demonic attack if they feel they are being faced with that. It would be completely irresponsible for a lay person to try to exorcise a demon out of a genuinely possessed person, because that is not only dangerous, it can kill the victim that they're trying to help. And, you know, you have to, there is a certain amount of skill that is required in this. There's a certain amount of training that is required in this. And if they don't have it, they shouldn't be playing around with those things. It's no different than saying, you know, anybody can cut open a person with a scalpel and try to perform heart surgery on someone who's going into cardiac arrest, but you wouldn't necessarily want anyone other than a trained surgeon to do that. It's the same thing with exorcism, or even just the basic functions of priesthood. And we're not even talking. We don't even have to talk about exorcism. I mean, you really shouldn't be even thinking that you can perform sacraments with an online ordination. That's just irresponsible, because you're not getting the type of understanding that you need in order to perform the sacraments validly and correctly. You know, there's a whole 2,000-year tradition that explains how this works. And no person from the modern day has the right to change 2,000 years of tradition. I mean, in order to do that, you need a synod of bishops, and they have to, you know, collaborate at an ecumenical council to even make one little minor change to the tradition. And then when they do that, you know, usually riles people up. I mean, Vatican II, for example, the Second Vatican Council, where the church changed a lot of its ways, created a schism. And we have these things, these people called traditionalists, traditional Catholics, or they're called sedevacantists. who, you know, reject all of the modern popes. They say they're all anti-popes, and anything that had anything to do with Vatican II, they see as actually of the devil. And this is what happens when you try to change tradition. So honestly, I think the person that you described there, Jason, is somebody who does not understand the religion that they think they practice, because the religion has very specific rules, and they're not rules that are just arbitrary decisions that are being made. They're rules that are there for very purposeful intentions. They're not accidental. There's reasons for every single thing that the church does, even if the laity don't always understand it. And that's tough, because it takes a lot of education to really understand some of these things. You have to have a really firm grasp of history, theology, and the very mechanics of sacramental theology itself. And the average person really doesn't have access to that information.
I know if I was going to surgery, I wouldn't want somebody that wasn't trained cutting on me. So that analogy really, really, really makes sense, that, you know, you don't want that. Hey, I wanted to add that, you know, we did have a couple callers that called in that have since hang up. So if anybody wants to call back, you know, the second part of the show, they can call back, and I'm sure Brian would be willing to take questions. And I also want to remind everyone that there is a chat room you can present questions to. It's not something I normally have open, but to be honest, I kind of forgot about it. So I'm being in the habit of keeping the chat room up. So it's normally not there, but it is there now if anybody has any questions.
So, Brian, yeah. What is your take on ashes? And there was a lot of, I can see without having to take up to your time, what is your overall feeling about people having ashes in their house?
I'm firmly against it. If you saw the most recent Ghost Adventures that I was on, the Sin City exorcism episode that aired a few weeks ago, I am absolutely, you know, the entire problem that was featured in that particular episode came back to the fact that the ashes were in the house, and they had not been properly ritually rested. And this is a common problem that we see in many cases where there are disturbances, because essentially it works like this, okay? There are going to be people just in all walks of life. You can see them, you know, anywhere you go. You're going to see people who are very spiritually advanced, almost naturally. And then you're going to see people who have almost no spiritual capacity whatsoever. And then you're going to see every possibility in between those two. So you're going to have like really natural, almost saintly-like people who are just really connected. And I'm not just talking about Christianity. I'm talking about, you know, just connected spiritually, regardless of their tradition. And then you have people that, no matter how hard they try, they can't seem to find a connection. And then you get all these different levels in between. And the same thing, that doesn't go away just because you die. Okay, so the spiritual proficiency that you cultivate while you're alive, you take with you into death. And so people who are more spiritually advanced, who have done the work in a particular tradition, and I kind of favor Buddhism and Christianity because, in my opinion, Buddhism and high liturgical Christianity like Orthodoxy and Catholicism are the highest expressions, I think, of human religion that is available to us at the present time. They give us a formula for properly directing our spirituality so that it's not just free-flowing and anything goes, because that's dangerous. That's actually not healthy. You need to have put boundaries on your religious, on your spiritual practice, and religion helps us to do that. That's one of the positive functions of religion. And so I always feel that, you know, liturgical Christianity and Buddhism are the best choices. Hinduism comes in a close second, but I always see Buddhism and Christianity as tied for first. So if you're a practitioner of one of those and you've made some achievements spiritually within the religion that you choose, then you're going to die in a state that's far more advanced and more capable than someone who has not done those things. maybe they never even practiced a religion, or if they did, maybe they didn't take it seriously or follow its tenets or really do anything to cultivate the grace of that particular religious path or tradition. And so what ends up happening is we tend to naturally attach to the things that are familiar. Because remember, I think we talked about this a few episodes ago when I was on this show, where when you die, people think that you go into some kind of, at least people who believe in an afterlife, think you go into some kind of spiritual state where it's basically just like this one, only without your body. And it's not. It's nothing like that. In fact, you don't have cognition. Okay, you don't have conscious thought. These are all qualities of a brain. And we all know that the brain doesn't go off to heaven. The brain, deteriorates and dies with the body, and it decomposes with the body. So when you lose your brain, you lose your capacity for cognitive function. So all you've got left is your spiritual instinct. That's it. So it's a more instinctual nature. It's not a thinking process. There is experience, there is awareness, but it is not consciousness as we understand it. There is no objective rationality that we have at our benefit right now as living people with a brain. So if you have cultivated an advanced spirituality and you've developed that spiritual nature so that your faculties of awareness are also sharper, then you're not going to have so much of a need to attach to the familiar. Because the first thing that's going to happen when you die, because all death is traumatic, it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're dying in your sleep. It doesn't matter if you're dying in a car accident or being murdered unexpectedly. All death is traumatic because it is a transitional state of being, just as birth was traumatic. You just don't remember it. But it was, I can guarantee you, extremely traumatic for each and every one of us. Because it's a transitional state of a transitional experiential state. Now, when a person who's very advanced dies, they're not going to feel the need to attach because they're not going to be as easily victimized by fear and the anxieties of that trauma. But a person who has not cultivated their spiritual state so that it's not very advanced and there aren't great leaps and bounds within their faculties of awareness, what's going to end up happening to them is they're just going to rush to whatever's familiar. And that's going to be the body. Okay. So essentially, because you're not being able to use your brain to logically think about this and say, you know what, I'm looking at my body right now. That looks pretty dead. So I must be dead. I have to move on. That's not the thought process that's going to occur at any point for any one of us, regardless of how advanced we are. What it's going to be is pure instinct. So it's going to be more like an animal, more like how an animal behaves, or even to bring even more, I guess you could say, a more vivid picture to it, it's more like how single-cell organisms behave. They are programmed instinctually to do certain tasks, and that's what they do. This is more of what spirits are like. And so if those are not very advanced conditions, then they will attach themselves to their body. This is what causes unrested spirits and what we would call in the vernacular ghosts or hauntings. So sometimes they first attach to the body, and then in many cases, as the body continues to decompose, they will eventually attach to the location where they lived, or even in more serious cases, where they died, if it was a traumatic death, like a murder or something like that. Sometimes they get attached because of the trauma of the type of death that they incurred, which is why hospitals are notoriously haunted locations. And prisons as well, because there's a lot of trauma in those locations. And this is why you see on Ghost Adventures, they tend to go to hospitals, sanatoriums, and prisons. And that's because they are great locations to interact with paranormal activity because there's just so much trauma there. And spirits get attached. So having ashes in the house, people think, oh, well, that's a different thing. So, like, nobody's going to put a corpse in a coffin and store that in their closet. You're not going to do that. You know, grandma dies, you're not going to put her into a box and, you know, let her quietly decompose in your closet. No one would even think of doing something like that. Even if it was legal, you wouldn't think of doing something like that. But that's exactly what putting ashes on your fireplace mantle is. It's the same remains. From the spiritual point of view, it's still the body. And so the spirit will attach to the condition that is the closest to what is familiar to it. So even once you completely annihilate that body in a crematorium, what remains, which is, you know, ashes with some particles of bone, still contains enough of the familiar essence for that spirit to see its concept of self. And so it will attach to those things and stay there. And so if a person who has a spirit attachment or a demonic attachment dies and is cremated, then not only does the spirit get stuck usually to those ashes, but the demonic attachment stays with the ashes as well. And that creates a demonic infestation, which is what you saw in the Sin City Exorcism episode that recently aired. So I am absolutely against it. All ashes, all body, regardless of whether or not you want a burial or you want, a cremation, it doesn't really matter which one you choose. Cremation is fine, but you have to rest the ashes. You can't keep them in an urn. That's very irresponsible from a spiritual vantage point, and it does lend the spirit to being attached. And like I said, most people are not, these days in particular, are not cultivating their spiritual life. They're really not. Religious practice is down. The churches that have increasing numbers tend to not even teach spirituality. They're really more feel-good places. They're playing rock music. They're preaching hellfire and brimstone or whatever, depending upon what kind of. But they're not engaging spiritually, which is what you would see in a liturgical tradition like Catholicism, where there's a rich spirituality. There's an interaction with God through the sacraments. And so all of that's what helps spirits to move on. So, you know, if you die, if you're very spiritually advanced and you die, then it doesn't really matter what happens to your ashes because you're not going to be attached to them anyway. But how are you going to be able to make that assessment for a loved one? How do you know really where they're at spiritually? No one really knows that between you and God. And so only you really know how much you've done to cultivate your relationship to God or whatever you call God or whatever you consider to be the divine. And honestly, if you haven't done much, then you're in danger. And so your family members put you in danger when they keep you around or, God forbid, turn you into like little diamonds to wear around their neck. I mean, there's some really sick practices out there. You've seen that, yeah. I mean, it's sick practices out there. And they think it's like sentimental or something. And they think it's a little clean box, and, you know, the ashes don't stink. There's no stench. So it's not really a corpse. It's not really a body. It's just, you know, it's a nice way of keeping grandma around a mantle. No, it's actually a good way to keep her stuck in limbo for all eternity. That's what you're risking. Now, if you want to risk that, by all means, go ahead and do it. The law lets you do it. But spiritually speaking, it is irresponsible. I absolutely forbid it. And any opportunity I get to teach against it, I do.
Well, go ahead, Jason.
This brings up a question, kind of an interesting question. So I live in a basement like a paranormal troll, and it was furnished. And the lady that owns the house, there's a big cabinet here. And on top of the cabinet are the remains of like all her previous cats. I never really paid any attention to it, and I didn't even think about it until we were talking about ashes. So what about the cremated remains of your pets? I haven't noticed any, like, phantom cats walking around or anything. What's your take on that?
Okay, that's a great question. I actually like this, and there's a lot of interesting answers I can give you about this, because we actually even had a case about 2.5 years ago that dealt with this very thing. They were having a poltergeist-like activity in the house, and we were trying to determine what the problem was. And I mean, there were some very interesting problems that they were experiencing within this location. and so bad that they were ready to just put the whole house on the market and move. And I think they might have even done so, even though we did actually fix the problem for them. But it wasn't until they actually finally told us that the ashes to their cat were on the mantle of their fireplace. And I said, well, geez, this must be the trigger source, because we couldn't find anything else that even remotely would have been the reason for this happening. So where does that lead us? So why is it sometimes it happens? Why doesn't it always happen? And what do we do with, you know, how do we look at it in terms of pets? Well, here's the thing with pets. Now, I don't think anybody has ever been haunted by the carcass of their turkey after eating Thanksgiving meal, where, you know, the bones of the bird go into the trash can for maybe a day or two. I don't think we've ever been haunted by a turkey after Thanksgiving. I mean, so these are remains. They are an animal. It doesn't happen. To my knowledge, I've never heard of a phantom turkey after Thanksgiving. I mean, maybe some people have had that experience. I've never heard of it. You know, so, I mean, we eat animals, and, you know, you have a steak, you T-bone steak or a porterhouse, and you throw the bone in the trash. You know, you're not going to get haunted by the cow, are you? Of course not, because we don't have any attachment to those animals. Those animals have no attachment to us, and not to mention that in the case of a butcher situation, they're being chopped into pieces, in which case the essence of their body attachment is being spread and distributed out to the various meat markets. And so that actually reduces the risk of there being any type of attachment, because they're being separated into several different locations. That's one explanation for it. The other explanation is we have no emotional attachment to them. And what causes attachment, what causes spirits to get stuck when there hasn't been a traumatic event that would have inflicted, because that's where the emotion comes from when they're traumatized in like a murder or an unexpected death, like a car accident where you're going to work and the last thing you expect to happen is you end up dead 2 minutes later when you get on the highway. Those are traumas, and we become emotionally affected as the victim of those traumas, and that can cause a self-attachment, which lets us linger and causes us to be unrested. But in the case of a person who dies maybe of cancer after living a long life, they're not going to be causing their own attachments typically. It's going to be their loved ones who cannot let them go, and they mourn too long. And they don't know how to let them go, or they haven't gone through the proper ritual burial rites of their particular tradition to help aid that, the facilitation of that separation of that spirit, so that it doesn't get stuck and attached. So with loved ones like pets, they do cause spirit attachments, because our feeling of loss, our love of our pets, is what gets them stuck and they stick around. Now the problem is, or I should say, the good thing about having the ashes of pets around versus the ashes of human beings is that pets don't have the same level of spiritual sophistication that human beings do, and so therefore their types of hauntings are much less severe. Typically, it's just going to be maybe feeling your cat rub up against your legs. And then it's like, what was that? And it's gone. I've experienced this. In fact, I have actually experienced the very phenomenon of a pet that I've lost sticking around for at least a few days before they finally took off. And that was, again, the mourning process that keeps them stuck there. You know, because you're sad, you miss your pet, and you know death is always going to be a somewhat traumatic thing for the living who are left behind. And so any kind of trauma, whether it's the trauma of the victim or it's the trauma of the people that are left behind by the death itself, are going to cause attachment. So it always comes through the emotions. Now, as spirits, as time goes on, spirits degrade. And so the attachments get less and less. So even the most haunted location on earth will not be haunted forever. It will eventually subside on its own, even without an exorcist's help. And this is why you can go to places that are truly ancient, and you don't typically hear of them being terribly haunted, although there will be sometimes activity because of the elemental energy that is present there. But that's a whole different ball game. I think pets should be rested too. Honestly, to get to your question, I really think anything that you love that you lose in death should be properly rested. You don't have to go through a full funeral rite for a pet, but you should release them. And the best way to do that is to scatter the ashes or to bury them in a place, preferably not on your property, to not give you any reason to mourn any longer than you have to. Death should be celebrated. It shouldn't be mourned. It's very hard to do. I fully understand that, but it's the best thing for the spirit. If you really care about that loved one, whether it's a pet or a family member, the best thing you can do for a loved one who dies is to celebrate their life and release them and let them go and go back to living your life as quickly as you can so that they move on.
That's how I feel too. And when I've done readings on people like that, that's the biggest thing. They can't let them go. And until they're ready, like you said, releasing, you're not releasing the person who's deceased totally. It makes total sense to me. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's true, and we see it all the time.
What can you do after the fact? Say I was haunted by a bunch of cats. What could I do? there we go. I've been waiting 10 minutes to hit that button. What can you do after the fact? Like, say, if you have the remains of a relative or even a pet or whatever, what can you do to alleviate any kind of activity from that?
Okay, for a pet, the best thing you can do is take the ashes and scatter them in a place that you feel your pet would have been very happy. A peaceful place, a place where they're not going to be disturbed, a place that doesn't get a lot of foot traffic. You know, you don't want to scatter them into the sewers or into the streets. I mean, you want to go to a place that's maybe natural and quiet, and a national park would be a good choice, a place that's not going to be disturbed in anytime soon. And just let them go. You don't have to even say a prayer. Just simply tell them it's okay to go, that you release them. You let them go. You let them be free. And that's the best thing that you can possibly do for them. And when you get back home, you know, you're going to have sadness, but, you know, work on getting over it and getting back to normal life as quickly as possible. Not avoiding them, not forgetting them, but don't over memorialize them either. So that's for pets. For humans, it's pretty much the same story, only a little bit more complicated, because again, now you're dealing with intelligence. And there's different levels of intelligence. You got cognitive intelligence, which is what we experience within our brains, but you have awareness intelligence, which is what we experience as spirits in our afterlife condition, or at least the condition that occurs immediately after death, which Tibetan Buddhism would call the bardo. In Christianity, it's essentially limbo, and so the reality is for releasing them is the rites in the church, it's the rite of Christian burial. And so the rite of Christian burial, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, is tailored to help to bridge that gap, to bring that spirit home, to give them the best chance to go back to God. And Buddhism, in particular, Tibetan Buddhism, because they have so many wonderful funeral rites, they read the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So monks will sit with the body. They leave the body alone for a minimum of 3 days, typically in the actual culture. So if you're out there in Tibet or, you know, right now northern India, Dharamsala, where most of the Tibetan exiles have relocated, they will let the body stay in the place that it died until they see the signs of release. And that can be a little bit more morbid to people here in the Western world, but this is actually the best thing. Tibetans do it the best. They are better than even the Christians as far as releasing spirits and giving them the best chance of not becoming what in Buddhism is called a hungry ghost. And so, giving them the funeral rite is necessary. You can't avoid that. And see, the danger here is that a lot of Protestant churches, not to disparage them, I have a lot of respect for Protestants. I have a lot of respect for non-denominational Christians. I mean, most of the people I serve are in those categories. I serve very few Catholics. Most Catholics don't have anything to do with me. I'm usually dealing with the non-denominational Christians. And so typically, their idea of a funeral is basically a gathering where everyone just gets together and talks and whatnot. And then they put the body in the ground and that's about it. But they're not performing an actual liturgical rite to help release that spirit. They're not saying prayers for them, because a lot of Protestant churches don't teach that you should pray for the dead. You have to pray for the dead, because most people are not spiritually proficient. They need your help. And if you've got grace that they don't have, you can give them that grace to help them move on. And our prayers can help them do that. And so if you have an urn in your house, then the best thing you can do is take those ashes to a place where you feel that they would have been happy. If it's the ocean, scatter them over the ocean. If it's the mountains, go up to the mountains and scatter them there. Say a prayer, releasing them, kind of what we talked about with the animal. And if you have access to a priest like myself who's willing to do these things, have the priest do it with you, because that would be even better, because they can impart certain graces that the laity do not have access to, and that even further facilitates it. The best thing you can do, though, is let the body rest for a minimum of 3 days, undisturbed, no autopsies, no embalming, just let them be. No refrigeration. I know that it's in the West, we can't even think of about these things, but it's very important that we form or lobby for laws that allow us to do these things. And then at that point, you come in, you do the funeral rites, and then you bury them, or you cremate them, and then you scatter the ashes, and then you bury the ashes or you scatter them. And then you're going to give that person the best opportunity for the best afterlife that they have access to. There is no other way to assure it. That assures it. And you'll never have a haunting. You'll never have an unrested spirit lingering. But, we had a case actually a few months ago where they were having great disturbances. The kids were affected. And then I sent my team in. I wasn't able to go to that investigation, but they were really having a lot of problems. So I sent my team in to go and assess the situation, because, sometimes we'll do pre-assessments if my schedule doesn't permit. And then once I find out from my team what we're dealing with, then, I have a better way of figuring out what needs to be done, and then I can go in at a later time and fix it. And so there was all this activity going on, and my team eventually determined that it was the husband to the grandmother who was the grandmother's still alive, the grandfather was dead. And the grandfather was there as an unrested spirit that was behaving very much like a wrathful spirit, which tends to happen if a unrested spirit lingers for too long. They eventually turn what appears to be demonic, because they start to lose their identity. Think Pirates of the Caribbean, the people that were on the Flying Dutchman, as they continued to serve on the ship, they became part of the ship. And remember Will Turner's father, by the time the third movie came around, he couldn't even remember his son anymore. Like that. Spirits degrade, just like that. That was actually a really wonderful archetypal portrayal of what it's really like. And so spirits degrade, and they lose their identity, and they become hostile, and they become angry because they're stuck. And that's why in Buddhism it's called hungry ghosts, because they're hungry for every type of attachment that we have in life, and they cannot satisfy it because they have no body in which to facilitate that interaction. So they will still feel that they need to eat, but they can't put food in their mouths, and they can never satiate themselves. They're sad, and they can never alleviate that sadness, and they become angry because of it. And then they start to cause illness to the living that they are around. So this family was told what's going on, what needed to be done. We needed I needed to go in and make contact with that grandfather and release him. And guess what the family said? We don't want to let him go. So I closed my case.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yep. They knew it was the grandfather. They knew he was still there. They knew he needed to be released, and they refused to let him go.
Yeah.
And I see that a lot, more often than I wish I, more often than I can even say, and I wish I didn't have to.
Well, I'm looking at the clock here, and wow, how time flies. We're just running out of time here. So if anybody wants to be able to get a hold of you or has any questions, how would they go about doing so?
There are so many ways to reach me now. You know, the best way, the quickest way, the easiest way is Twitter, because that's the one I handle myself. I have my staff basically handles Facebook, email. All of those will eventually get by me. They, you know, they read them, and then, you know, they pick really important ones and then send them to me. But I tend to read all of them too. I could not possibly respond to them all because too many come in. But you can always reach me on Twitter. I try to be very active there, and that is at Exorcist Bishop. Just go to Twitter and type in at Exorcist Bishop, and you will see me there. And you can send a tweet my way, and I will try to always answer everyone that I see. If you are in need of help, we now have a spiritual crisis office that you can call Monday through Thursday, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that's 678-871-6766. And Brandy, who's my personal assistant, operates that line. She devotes all of her time to that. So you can always call that office, and she can help you the best that she can. You can also email me at office@nicholean.org. That's office@nicholean.org, and that will get to me as well. We are also in the process of opening up a mission church, and we should have it ready by Ash Wednesday, which is ironically Valentine's Day this year. So February 14th is when we're hoping to get it open, and so you can send mail directly to the church office at 1241 Joe Frank Harris Parkway in Cartersville, Georgia, 30120. That is our public office and public place of worship. We have a church there that we're going to be setting up. It's not set up yet. We just opened it. They're actually working on the floors right now because they needed to be redone. But once the floors are done, we'll be setting up the office, and you can send mail there right now, and it will get to us. And you can also come in and stop in and visit us once we're fully operational.
Wow, that's a lot of changes, positive changes.
Yeah, we have too much demand. I was doing 2 cases a month, but we're getting 30 or 40 cases a month. And I cannot go to more than 2 houses in 1 month. I don't have the time. So this way we're going to be able to open, maybe see 5 or 6 clients a day. And then they can come in, and we'll just see them one after another and assess them right there, and maybe be able to fix what their problem is right on the spot. Because most people who have spiritual crises are just need some spiritual direction, or at the worst, they need a solemn blessing or the rite of unction. Most people do not need me to come to their house and perform an exorcism. Most places are not demonically infested, and most people that are having spiritual problems have a spiritual attachment that is internal to themselves. And so I can fix that by you coming to me a lot quicker than I can setting up an appointment 3 or 4 months in advance. So yeah, it's going to be really good. It's going to be very good for everyone, and we'll be able to help so many more people this way.
Quickly, Brian, before we have to leave, I have a question. What happens when a person says, well, you know, I lived a bad life, and I'm going to die, but I'm going to accept Jesus so I can go to heaven? I'm just curious on what the thing is, because I hear a lot of that. You know, people want to make sure in the last moment they hope to go to heaven instead of hell if they accept Jesus or turn their life around in their last days or whatever, or hours or whatever.
Right. It's a little bit of a loaded question, but I can give you a quick answer. Essentially, if a person accepts Jesus on their deathbed, from a Christian perspective, from the perspective of the church, if a person does accept Jesus on their deathbed and they receive baptism. That's important. That's part of accepting Jesus. It's not just about saying, you know, Jesus, I believe in you. Although there is baptism by desire. So in an emergency situation, if you desire baptism, you can be granted it by proxy. It is, there is a provision for that within sacramental theology. Assuming all that takes place, and then even though they did not cultivate their spirituality while they're alive, which gave them the proficiency to move on, as long as they have that baptism, as long as they have accepted or given their life over to Christ, then the grace of that will put them into what the church calls purgatory. And it's in that condition of purgatory that the rest of their failings can be perfected. So what they failed to accomplish in life can be accomplished in purgatory. The fact of the matter is, without that grace, everyone ends up in limbo. Limbo eventually leads to hell. But if you have that grace, everyone with that grace goes to purgatory, and everyone in purgatory eventually ends up in heaven. That's classic Christian theology. It really is, even though I know a lot of people will dispute me on that, particularly, you know, non-Catholics that don't, or even Catholics that don't understand their own history of the theology. But that's essentially what happens. So it's always a good thing. It might not give an immediate result. It might not, but if you have that grace and you have the funeral rites and you pray for that soul, they won't get attached. They won't get stuck. They will move on to a better condition.
All right. Wow. Well, with that, we're gonna have to close out. We're out of time. Brian, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show once again. It's always great to have you on and very informative.
Always a pleasure, Jason. Sherry, anytime, just let me know. I'll always be willing to come on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I already shot you a message. So, yes, I'd love to have you back always. It's amazing, and all the things that you can share with us, and we appreciate you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
What
God
a fantastic
bless.
Show.
Take care. All right, Sherry.
Yes.
What do we got coming up
next
week?
Next week, we're going to talk about, it's going to be a little bit different. So we're going to have our first-time guest. His name is Austin Shipley, and he will be on, and he's going to talk about the Wiccan, just the Wiccan philosophy. So it's going to be quite interesting. Open our ears and just see what we can learn as listeners. So, like I said, anytime that we post anything or say, it doesn't naturally, you know, is our thoughts or our belief system. We just want to go and share what we have that's out there, and you can decide whether you want to believe in it or share it or your own thoughts. So anyway, we just thought we'd give you some different variety of subjects for entertainment, and hopefully you'll learn and grow and you can share it with others for the highest good.
Absolutely. Well, with that, I guess we can close the show. Again, I want to remind anybody, if anybody wants to be mildly entertained and see me do a virtual reality walkthrough, the VR game Affected the Manor, which would be the equivalent of the worst possessed house on the planet. Way worse. I mean, it's crazy. It's a scary thing. You can check that out on Paranormal Horizons Facebook page. And with that, Cher, I guess we'll close it out. And we'll see everybody next Sunday, 8 p.m. West Coast time, for another episode of Paranormal Horizons.
Hey, thank you, everybody. And thank you for your support. Take care. Peace.
Good night, everyone.